Good evening. My name is Mary and I am an addict.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, family. I would like to take a moment to get with the God of my understanding so this can be a clear message of Narcotics Anonymous and not Mary's mess. Can you help me with that? Thank you. I'm Mary and I'm an addict.
Hi, Mary.
First and foremost, I want to thank the God of my understanding for allowing me to be here tonight clean, because I know it truly does not have to be that way. And I want to welcome the newcomers. You truly are the most important person in any meeting, because I can only keep what I have by giving it away. The topic tonight is We Do Recover, and it's a wonderful, wonderful chapter in our basic text. If you haven't read it, please read it. And I challenge you to take a step farther and try to apply some of the spiritual principles encompassed in that chapter in your lives as I have done, because it really does work. And I'm going to share my story with you, and it is my story. It's not anyone else's but mine. So if you can identify, please do. The first sentence in We Do Recover is the most profound sentence to me. And it's a huge concept that it took a long time for me to understand. It says recovery begins with surrender. And for me, I was in active addiction for 23 years. And that's over half of my life. So when I finally decided to come into this process, and it wasn't that I decided. I had a lot of help getting here, and it wasn't always, the help that I would have chosen, court ordered, whatever. But there's a personal part of it that I had to come to grips with, when the pain got greater than the pleasure of living the way I was, existing out in active addiction. I had to totally surrender my will and my life, and that took action. This program, for me, does not just happen. It takes a lot of work, and it takes work for me on the inside, and that's what I try to do. And I do that on a daily basis as best of my ability. I'm a perfectionist. But I have to remember that it's progress, not perfection. And I have a lot of wonderful people in my support network that are my eyes and my ears, and they help me and call me out when they see me not, living up to all that I can be. And for that, I am truly grateful. I'll give you a little bit of past qualifications. And mine starts at birth. I was born September 4th of 64. And I was given up for adoption. And I laid in an orphanage in Rochester for 7 months. And I don't want you to feel sorry for me. I want you to identify with the feelings that I felt, please. Through those 7 months, I laid there. There was not a whole lot of interaction. There was not a whole lot of love and nurturing. And anybody that knows a bit about psychology knows that the bonding process happens in those first 6 months. That's where trust is built in human beings. And because of the fact that I wasn't picked up, I wasn't cared for, I had big bald spots on my head where, they had just rolled me, they propped bottles, and they did the best they could, I'm sure. When my adopted parents adopted me March 26th of 65, they said I was eating, fruits, and when my mom tried to feed me that, I would choke, So what they said and what was reality were two different things. So that's where I came from, and I say that, I talk about this adoption piece, because today at 43, I still have issues that revolve around being birthed and being given up. And those issues are abandonment, rejection, and the need to be needed, to fit in somewhere. So my process started at birth. In March of 65, I had two wonderful people that adopted me into their family. And they were the most loving and caring people that I will ever know. I got emotional on that because growing up, you know, I had what I needed. I didn't always have what I wanted, but I was instilled with some values and some morals and some beliefs that they hoped would carry me through my young adult life and into adulthood. And I cry thinking about that today because how much I missed, you know, and how much I really didn't know because I was caught in the grips of active addiction. My father passed away in '89 of colon cancer, you know, and I wasn't there in the capacity that my mom needed me to be there for her or for him. And for that I regret, but I can't change the past. And the past, I don't regret my past today. My past has made me who I am today, and that is a strong survivor. But I've learned through the process of Narcotics Anonymous and applying the spiritual principles encompassed in our steps and traditions that I don't have to stay the way I was. You know, I can recover. We do recover. Through school, I was in sports and music. Those were my fortes that I loved. My schoolwork was okay. It wasn't the best, but I didn't apply myself. I never brought a book home, but somehow or other I managed to graduate from high school in 1982. I then went to college on the pretense that I was going to be a physical therapist. But also in the year before that I graduated, I met a man that was 6 years older than me, who ended up to be my first husband. And instead of finishing college, I dropped out of college and I married him. And I took on a new occupation. And that occupation was selling drugs for him. So he would work the 3 to 11 shift, and I would go down to the local tavern and sit and sell the chemicals that we had. And that was my life. That was where I fit in. And I did it well. But there was a lot of pain with that. There was a lot of jealousy. You know, there was a lot of physical beatings. Even though I was doing what he asked me to do, when he would come there at midnight, you know, in order to sell a product, you have to have a speech, you know, and you have to sell it. And I was of the personality that was wonderful to talk to, and I had a whole line of baloney, and I was good at it. And that was a survival mechanism that I carried through my active addiction. And not so proud of it, but at that time, looking back now, at that time, that's how I survived. That's how I got through. I was not in reality, and I had to rationalize and justify what I was doing to continue to do it, because I wasn't raised that way. So anyway, that marriage lasted 2 years, and by God's grace, I was never arrested for selling drugs, although I was arrested for DWI in 85, and that was my first one. From there, another part of who I am and my defects in character, I'm a very codependent caretaker, rescuer, people pleaser. I thought that if I took care of everybody around me, that I was needed, that I felt important. And today I don't have to live like that. Today I realize that I have to come first, because anything I put before my recovery, I lose. But at that time, you know, the external validation is what made me whole. And so on that codependent part, I always felt that I had to have a man. So when I divorced my first husband, I went right into another relationship, and I was with that one for 5 years. And then I left that one, and I went to another one that I married. And the best part of that marriage was the two beautiful daughters that I have out of it. But all of them, each and every one of these relationships that I stayed in, the common denominator was drugs, you know, and that's where I was. That's what I did, and that's all I knew. Although something inside in that gut where my intuition has always said, you know, Mary, this just isn't where you should be. But I didn't go with that. You know, it was easier just to pick up a chemical and medicate, you know, to feel or not to feel. And so I got pretty good at doing just that. And it caused me a whole lot of pain, emotionally, physically, spiritually, mentally. But I still continued because that's all I knew. And now I'm up to about 1990 is when I married my husband that I had my daughters with. And that marriage lasted 4 years. And, you know, we were addicted to prescription medications. And, you know, we were in emergency rooms every day, sometimes twice a day. He would fake a migraine and get a shot of Demerol, and then we'd get a little bit of medicine to carry us through for the next 24 hours, and sometimes it didn't last that long because, you know, it's a progressive illness, and the tolerance that you build to a chemical, you need more and more and more. And so, you know, I found myself driving all over New York State, and I mean all over New York State. I don't think that there's too many hospitals in New York that I haven't visited, and I had two babies in the back seat, and I believe they were probably 1 and 2, 1 and a half and 3, somewhere in there. They're 13 months apart, you know, and he would go do what he had to do, and I would be stuck in this car feeding these children Cheerios and bottles and changing diapers and all kinds of weather, you know. So I say that to let you know about the insanity that I've been through, you know, and how it didn't matter. I mean, I have these two blessed children, but they weren't the priority. The drug was the priority, you know, and that's sad. But as I said, I am who I am today because of what I went through yesterday. Then the story gets real bad. The marriage didn't work. He wasn't willing to get into recovery. I got arrested for writing prescriptions because I got tired of going to the doctor, so I just took it upon myself to the doctor that I was working for at the time, just took his pad and started writing for him. And my husband told on me, and I was arrested January 18th of 94. So at that time, now I got some charges. So I say how I came in here, part of it was my own doing, but back then, no, it was court mandated. You know, you either do this or you go to jail. Well, I didn't want to go to jail. So I went down to an inpatient program down in Ovid, and I wasn't ready. I had no clue. I couldn't say I was an addict because, you know, alcohol was my drug of choice. You know, I was very confused. And so, follow the rules? No, I didn't follow the rules. Got caught kissing a boy in the bushes, and they sent me home. You know, those are the behaviors. You know, our literature says if the drugs don't get you, the lifestyle will. Well, guess what? For those 4 or 36 days, I put down the drug. But I didn't know nothing about living. I didn't know anything about, you know, spiritual living. You know, so I did what I did on the street prior when I was using. I come in this day, I come into to this rehab, and I'm just supposed to be different. And guess what? It didn't work that way for me. You know, I was, I balked authority. You couldn't tell me. I knew it all. And I'll do whatever the heck I want. And that's what I did. And actions equal consequences. And I got kicked out. And the judge wasn't real thrilled. And he said, oh, you'll do 6 months in county jail. So, and that was my first bid in jail. It was in 94. And I got out of that and left the husband alone because it was all his fault. And see, I didn't know at the time when I was going through this in 94 that my ex-husband had gotten caught himself a month prior. And instead of owning up to his responsibility and the part that he played in it, he silver-tongued the whoever and told on me, and he got off, and I went to jail. But I didn't learn that until 10 years later, you know, and it's neither here nor there. But that, I say that to let you know how sick I was, how sick he and I were, you know, and it hurts. It hurts to know, but you know, there's an old saying, and it comes from, I learned it in the jailhouses, you know, you play, you pay, you know. I didn't understand the concept of that. Today I do. So when I got out of jail on that six-month bid, went right to the bar because that's what I knew, you know, and I'll fix them, and I'm not on probation, you know. The judge said, you know, you're not a candidate for probation. You don't do a thing we say. So, you know, that sentence was good. But I went right to the bar where that's where I lived, and met another man just as sick as me. And I'm going to have to go a little farther, sorry, Lord, but he was sicker than me. This man beat me every day for 4 years. I had him arrested once a year for 4 years. The scar that I have on my face was from him, where he hit me over the head with a bottle and put 35 stitches in my face. And he ended up going to prison. And we shared a son. Derek was 6 months old at the time. And I'll never forget, it was June 16th in 96 that I went in front of the bar because I had the two girls and this baby, and I was left to take care of it by myself. But I was drinking and drugging every day. You know, I needed a break. I deserved to have some time for me, and there wasn't any because I was trying to be responsible. So I packed the kids up, and I went into the front of the bar, and I had the car seat, and I sat here in front of the window, and I set him down, and that's when he came out, and all this happened. So I packed the kids back up, and I went to my mom's. And it was a thunder and lightning storm, and it was so bad that I didn't even realize I was bleeding. But when I got to my mom's house, I mean, I was just soaked in blood, and when she saw me, she said, "Oh, God, Mary Clarice, he slit your neck." You know, she was waiting for me to die behind him. And we found out it was just this, and I say just this because it could have been worse. I should have been dead so many times in this process. I should have been dead, but God's got a greater plan, and I'm here today to say he does, and I'll share that with you. So that is the destructive part. After my baby's daddy went to jail, I said, you know, we had just bought a house, and I didn't want to be responsible. I wanted to continue using drugs. So what I had to do is I had to move in to where the drug of choice was so that I was the center of attraction. Because, see, I have a whole lot of control issues. And if I can't be the top dog, then I'm not going to be part of it. And so I moved right into the drug house and started. I said to myself, and I remember these words, you know, I've had a good life. Let me see what it's like to have a bad life. Well, boy, did I regret those, because when I started going down that ladder, I went down quick. And, you know, I did a lot of people great harm, the ones that loved me, and they couldn't believe that, you know, these people's daughter that are upstanding in the church type citizens, and she's on Water Street selling drugs, you know, at the lowest low. But that's where I was, and I was there for 3 years. And I was ripping and running, and in the process of that, ended up with all kinds of charges, you know, disorderly conducts, resisting arrest, you know, obstruction of governmental administration. The list goes on. I have a 10-page rap sheet. But the hardest part of all that was that when I didn't stay in the house and do the job that I was supposed to, when I got tired and I needed some air, I'd leave. And when I left, as I said, alcohol is my drug of choice, and so I was always drinking. I was always drinking. So I got in a car, and every time I got in a car, I got pulled over. And every time I got pulled over, I got a DWI, and I went to jail. Okay? I'm here to stand to tell you that I have 5 felonies. I have 5 DWIs. On the third one, it was over here in Ontario County. And I'll never forget my singing Judge Harvey. "Oh, Miss Palumbo, we do things differently in this county. You'll be going upstate for 1 to 3 years." That's how he sang to me. And I'm trying to remember how I felt, because I wanted to laugh because it was funny the way he was singing it. But inside I was crying because I knew this was it. You know, I was going to prison. They had had enough of me and my annex. And so off to Bedford I went, and I was there for a couple weeks, and then I went to Albion. And I had a 1 to 3, and I did 2 full years. I did 2 out of the 3 years because I didn't make my boards. But I have to stand here and tell you that those 2 years from 2001 until 2003 were the best years of that time, because I got in touch with my higher power again. I learned how to weld. I learned how to live on no money. I got $2.73 every 2 weeks, and I was able to buy 1 pack of USA menthol cigarettes for $2.71 at commissary every 2 weeks. So needless to say, I had not a whole lot of necessities. I had no family. No one, everybody had tough loved me. No one had wanted any part of me, except for my godfather. And he would send me, I don't know, two or three packs of cigarettes every, you know, 3 months. You know, he was a good old guy. And he just wanted, he knew the potential that I had, and he backed me, and he helped me there. But Albion taught me that, you know, it wasn't all about me. I was in there with 1,500 women that I didn't know and didn't like. So what I had to do to survive, I had to use that street mentality in the prison in order to get by. But I made a decision then that I was going to change my life, and it was going to start right here in the behind the walls of Albion Prison. And I was in the chapel all the time. I did some good things. I did some really good things to help incorporate, like, the inner face. We had all different kinds of faiths, and I would prayer services that would bring all of us together. You know, there were some good times in prison, although there were some times where it wasn't so good, too. And I need to tell you that there were drugs everywhere. There were drugs everywhere. But I chose not to partake for those 2 years. And for that, I'm grateful, because that was the basis. And I attended Narcotics Anonymous in prison. It was introduced to me. And out of 1,500 women, this is the part that really makes me shake my head. And out of 1,500 women, probably 1,300 of them were in there for either drug offenses or drug-related offenses. And the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous were maybe 10 or 12 every week. So, you know, recovery was available, but people weren't ready for recovery. You know, they wanted to still continue to live the way they wanted to live. But I decided to do something different. And I met this wonderful, wonderful woman, the chaplain there, and she's still my spiritual advisor today. And a dear friend who was down last week and still comes and helps me work on the inside stuff, because, you know, happiness is an inside job. I can't get it from you or you or you. You can make me happy, but you can't fulfill the void inside of me that only my God can fill. And for so many years, I ran around trying to get an outside external force to fulfill that, and I was always disappointed. And because I was disappointed, my drug use continued to progress. I was released the 6th of February of 2003 to a halfway house, and I did 97 days there, and really was working a good program, so I thought, except for recovery starts with surrender. That's what, and we do recover. Does that mean, you know, 98% I surrender, or does that mean 100%? Well, for me, it means 100%, because I only surrendered 98%. And I told the counselors, yes, I don't want to go to supported living. I want to go back to my boyfriend, to my home. I have a home. That was my reservation. Hello. Doing the same thing. I've been gone for 2.5 years. I walked into that house, and the same people doing the same thing, same chemicals, and there I sat trying to stay clean. And guess what? It worked. It worked. I stayed clean. For 3 days. 3 days. 3 days could I listen to the beer tops popping and the lighters flapping in the bathroom and people geeking and holding the bath. Shh. I thought I had some recovery. I had 2 years clean from prison, and I had this inpatient that I had, halfway house that I did. I know how to live. Except for when it comes to that 2% that I want to hold on to. Well, let me tell you something. For me, I can't hold on to any percent, because when I drive the bus, I crash every time. And today, the consequences are too grave to bear. I choose not to. It's easier. You know, surrender is a wonderful word. We lose to win. And that took a long time for me to figure out, because I was a tough girl, you know, 10-foot tall, bulletproof, couldn't tell me anything. You know, how am I going to surrender? That's weakness. Can't show that, you know. But guess what? When you're in a safe environment like the fellowship and the program of Narcotics Anonymous, I'm free to be who I am. You know, I don't have to put all those fronts and those masks and those defense mechanisms that I had to use out there. In here, I don't have to do that. I come just as I am, my hair horning up. It don't even matter, you know, because it's not about my outside today. It's about my inside. And that's what took a long time for me to understand. And that was a block for me for a long time to get into the recovery process. Let's see. I violated. I stayed there at that house, and my probation or parole officer came, and he said, "Mary, you got to go." And on the 15th of September of 2003, I went back to Bedford, and then I went to Bayview, and I did my 90-day hit down in New York City. On the 14th of January, I was released to the bus station to come to Rochester for parole, to meet my parole officer. And it was a terrible, terrible storm, and it didn't much matter to me. The problem that I had was the lady put 61 instead of gate 65, and I missed the bus. So here I am in a city that I don't know anybody. And I'm on that fence thinking that I got recovery and I want to do this, but God, I'm scared because I don't know anybody, so what am I going to do? And guess what I did? The old familiar. I went right to the store and got a 40-ounce, and I went into the bus station bathroom and drank it. And I got on the bus and took this long ride up. Well, the bus stopped in Geneva. And at 8:30 that night, and this is important about progression, at 8:30 that night, I got off the bus in Geneva. I put all my prison garb behind the bus station, forgetting that I'm in prison garb, those sexy jeans and that bright yellow shirt and that big old coat and them pretty black boots. And I went across the street to a bar. And there was nobody in there but three people. Two of them were off-duty cops. And then this other guy. Oh, well, and I'm sitting there like, yeah, they're not going to know. They don't know me. They knew of me by my the way I was dressed. And I started to pound the drinks. And I couldn't go home with the two cops, they said, but I could go home with this Billy guy. And if you're in here, Billy, I'm sorry, because I still don't know what you look like. I still don't know what your car looks like that I stole. But I'll tell you, at 12:29, 4 hours later, I was in OCJ with another DWI. 4 hours. That's how my disease progressed. And I hadn't drank for 2.5 years. 3 years. Okay? And I remember, but I don't remember. I remember the girls telling me that when I got into the jail and in the Sally Port, I dropped to my knees and I grabbed my hair and I said, "Oh my God, I cannot do this again." You know, and I'm still on parole, mind you. I still got 6 weeks of parole to go on my fourth DWI that I just did prison time for and violated. So I'm looking at 5 to 15 years back in prison. And I was out of my mind. But there was a surrender that happened. And as drunk as I was, it happened and I didn't even know it. You know, for me to fall on my knees and say, "Lord, I cannot do this anymore." And I got my God is so good. You know, I was offered, instead of 5 to 15 years, I was offered an alternative to incarceration program. And I opted for that. And I had to do 6 months up front in jail. And then when I got out May 24th of 2004, I went to an inpatient, a 28-day inpatient. I did 24 days there. And then instead of going through the halfway house again, because I'd already done that the year before, they put me right into supportive living in Canandaigua. And I'll tell you what, from that moment on, life has been good. Life has been good. Recovery started then. Has it been easy? No. Has there been bumps? Yeah. Have I fallen? Yeah. But guess what? I am who I am today by what I went through yesterday. I love where I live. I love the people and the recovery that I have in my hometown. Alcohol, as I said, was my drug of choice, and I was pretty confused about AA and NA. And I had a sponsor that came into the jail who was a member of AA, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said yes. And when I came out of this whole cycle, she was still there for me, and so she and I worked together. But see, my disease is so much deeper. It wasn't just the chemical. It was the behaviors, the thoughts, and the attitudes that I had no clue about. And I'm trying to do this diligent program that she's asking me, but it's not touching my heart. And I went through that for a while, 21 months. And I had a reservation that once I get good enough, I can use again. Just one. And I won't even use my drug of choice. I'll use something else because I can control that. Well, I'm here to say that I relapsed on the 28th of October of 2005, after 21 months. And that hurt a lot of people. And that was the first time I got to see, you know, I had some time in this process of good recovery. And it wasn't just about Mary anymore. It was about all my friends that supported me. And I watched them. They loved me from a distance because they had to protect themselves. And I understand that today. At the time, I didn't understand anything. All I knew is that I was bankrupt. I remember laying on my floor. And I couldn't get up. Couldn't get up. But I wanted to get up. I wanted to stop, and I couldn't. And the only thing I knew to do was to call my probation officer, because I was on probation. And I told on myself, because see, there's three principles that I can't live without: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I had to be honest, and I wasn't feeling good inside because I wasn't being honest. I'm the only one that knew I was using. But that was enough. That was too much. And I had to call somebody, and I called my parole officer, and I left her a message. Please help me. This is what happened. This is where I'm at. Call me. It was on a Sunday night. Monday morning, she called, and she said, "Oh, Mary, I can't believe that message." I said, "Yeah, what do I do?" She said, "You come in and see me." In fact, between her and the Alternatives to Incarceration program, the two of those coordinators got together, and I went down and saw this other lady, because I was on my way to New York City for 4 days, from the 1st of November to the 4th, you know, and I had the plane ticket, I was ready to go, but here I am thinking I can use before I go on a vacation. I rewarded myself. No, I didn't reward myself. I self-sabotaged what I had. The goodness, I had a good job, I had some money, I had a plan, and I goofed it all up because I don't know success and I don't know failure. I don't know how to live happy. I don't know how to live. Well, through God's grace, I was still able to go on that vacation, but I was so scared when I was in New York City that I spent 4 days in a hotel room, and I never left. I never got to see Manhattan. I never did anything because I knew if I got to Manhattan, I know what would happen. Just what happened on the 14th of January when I tried to get on a bus, because if I get lost, I'm scared, and what do I do? Everything I always used to do. Expecting different results? I don't know. Probably expecting just what I got. Hi. So that's the story of the destruction. Now I want to talk about the good part. And I only got 5 minutes to do it, but that's all it's going to take. Because when you hear what I've been through, as you just heard, and where I am today and where I'm standing today, this program works if you allow it to work in your life. I stand here before you today as a licensed practical nurse from the state of New York. They have forgiven all of my DWIs. I went through the course. I took it. I passed. I went through the state boards, and I passed those. Thinking the license was coming, another bump in the road. I got red flagged in Rochester at the Office of Corrections, and they said, "Oh, well, we need a current evaluation. We need a current, because the 2005 was too old, evaluation. They need my criminal record and my accusatory instruments and all this." And I'm saying, "Oh my God," I called my sponsor, and I started crying. I said, "I know that for nothing." She said, "Mary, stop it. Stop it. You are who you are. That's your past." You know, and I have this one saying that I'm going to say, you know, people that matter don't mind, and people that mind don't matter. And that's how I live today. If you're with me, that's great, because you're doing what I'm doing. If you're not with me, that's okay, too, because I don't want to be with you, because you'll get me dirty before I'll get you clean. You know, and so I had some faith, and I did the work, the footwork. Go get the record. Send them up there. Go get the evaluation. Pass it. And the people in my life, because they know me from these treatment centers, were so grateful, because they used to chase me out when I was going out the door, chasing me, just holding on, saying, "Please don't go, please don't go, follow our way." Now, that 2% of will took me back out. So I say all that to say that we do recover. It's a process. It takes time. But I'm a living example that if you apply the principles that are encompassed in this basic text, and there's many, no matter what problem I have, I can go to a chapter, or I can go to a paragraph, it's not even a chapter, and I can find me in it, and I can intuitively know what I have to do. You know, my life is good today. My girls are here with me for the weekend. I had visitation with them. You know, so many things. I have a new car that I bought at my two-year anniversary on November 1st again. You know, things, just because I relapsed, didn't mean that it stopped there. That's where it really started, because then I knew it had to be total surrender. And from that point on, I got me an NA sponsor. I got into the step working guide, and I started doing, to the best of my ability, the step work, because I am not perfect at that, and I procrastinate. But I know that when I stop doing my step work, I start falling over and kind of straddling that fence, not really secure in the principles that I'm trying to implement in my life today. So with that said, today, securing the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, I can stand here before you, look you in the eye, and be okay with who I am. I'm Marion. I'm an addict.